You're watching Network Radio. Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center. Center.
2015 is coming to a close, and we have the brilliant Dr. James Fetzer on, who's going to talk to us about what 2015 meant and what happened during it, a year of divisiveness within the truth movement, a year of religious extremism, and a year of false flag religious extremism. Dr. James Fetzer is the brightest and most integrous person in the truth movement, and I can say that because I've been in the truth movement longer than Dr. Fetzer. I've been in it longer than Alex Jones, longer than Jeff Rentz, longer than David Wilcock. I've been in it since I was a teenager and I shared the stage with the great William Cooper. Now what that means is I spent a long time going all the way down all the rabbit holes and doing a lot of investigating, and the fact is this is not the end of the road for us. We are going to find solutions and we're going to focus on solutions as best we can, but we cannot come up with solutions unless we at least identify the problem. And for that, we need researchers and we need bravery and we need the kind of people in this world that teach us as effectively as our guest today, Dr. James Fetzer. So roll the song, Don, if you've got it going. Do we have the song? We can do it. Yes, we can.
We can do it. Yes, we can. We can change things throughout the land.
I'm as mad as hell,
but we all
must take this anymore.
Lend a hand. We can do it. Oh, yes, we can. Oh, your neighbor over there, a bit bewildered, but he cares. He just doesn't know what to do. Join together, and then there'll be two. There are others all around, scattered throughout the town. Reach out and you will see your numbers swell to three.
We can do it, yes we can. We can change things throughout the land, but we all must lend a hand. We can do it. Oh, yes, we can.
James Fetzer, and you're at TruthVersusNews.inc, the little homespun Seattle TV show that's apparently getting at least a little bit of attention around the world. We've had a lot of breaking news on this show and breaking insight, and we have the author of Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, the book that was banned by Amazon and now is available free online. You can find that at Rents.com. Because of that ban, it's being distributed a lot more widely than it would have been, and thanks to Dr. Fetzer's brilliant move of putting it free on the web as soon as Amazon tried to ban it. So we have a lot to cover today. Welcome, Jim. It's great to have you again, as usual.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kevin. I want to cover what I take to be the top 10 stories of the year, broken into segments, and invite your comments in relation to solutions about each.
Thank you.
The big story of the year, I believe, is the discovery that ISIS was made in the USA. We have, as this slide shows, a Defense Intelligence Agency document facilitating the rise of the Islamic State in order to isolate the Syrian regime that was unearthed by Judicial Watch on 18 May. Was a major development. There were many other indications, as the next slide shows, that something was afoot, where the Iraqi army, for example, downed two UK planes carrying weapons for ISIS. About a week later, as the next slide shows, Iraqi popular forces shot down a U.S. helicopter that was also providing supplies and weapons for ISIS.
Number those slides when you talk, Jim.
Yeah.
Say number, the number of them. Okay.
That was
three.
That was number four.
Okay, that was three. We're on four? Okay.
Number five reflects that we even have photographs of ISIS members sporting U.S. Army tattoos. There are quite a lot of that out there, remarkably enough. And in slide six, we have what was purloined, actually hacked out of an assistant to Senator John McCain, a video showing the beheading videos being staged on a studio in either Tel Aviv or Hollywood. Kevin, it's very distressing that the American government has been so hypocritical, lying to the American people, exaggerating the ISIS threat when the United States was responsible for creating ISIS. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I know. Kevin's on your false flag. I'm activist angel on this one. The evidence is just overwhelming. What's stopping it from getting out to most people? Is it really the mainstream media or the psychology of people not wanting to know?
Well, activists, I think that most Americans are in a state of cognitive dissonance where they want to suppress or deny information at odds with their core beliefs. And when the government has spent such a massive amount of time with propaganda suggesting ISIS is the greatest threat in world history, as it were, it's very difficult for the average American being bombarded by this kind of propaganda from all the major networks again and again and again to think clearly about it, particularly when they don't have the analytical resource and research resources to go onto the net and do their own research. I'm hopeful that by programs like this, we can reach out to the public and enable them to better understand what's taking place.
Well, the research is extraordinary, just as it is in your book. So let's carry on and look at it some more.
Well, one of the earlier events during the year was the Charleston church shooting at Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church on 17 June. As the next slide, number eight, shows, we had a suspect, Dylan Roof. Well, it's interesting that on the left you see his jacket with two apartheid nation patches, but those weren't on his jacket originally.
No.
Those were photoshopped. And there's a principle under the law that fraud vitiates everything. In other words, once you discover indications that a story is fraudulent, if we transfer it to the public domain, we're entitled to regard the entire story as fraudulent. Slide number nine shows another proof, because we have a 24-hour clock showing Dylan Roof purportedly entering the church at 0800. It appears, Angel, that whoever put it together didn't realize that that meant 8 a.m. rather than 8 p.m. And got it wrong. Here he's wearing a $1,000 bulletproof vest as he enters into the church. As slide 10 shows, moreover, this celebrated minister, Clementa Pinckney, was featured in an open casket memorial service, but it doesn't look at all like the pastor himself. This person has much too dark a complexion, much too thick a neck, and appears to be of Haitian origin. Remarkably, Angel, Hillary Clinton just happened to be in town that day and sent her personal photographer over to the church to take photographs. And yet Dylan is alleged to have loaded and reloaded four different times. The pews would have been all shot up, splintered, wood, blood all over the place, the altar a mess. And yet they conducted a normal church service within 48 hours. I'm sorry to say, Angel, that this is one more in a series of false flag attacks that have been staged by our own government to instill fear into different segments of our population, in this instance, to instill fear into blacks.
I think it was either Dr. Ewan or Vivian Lee in your book that talked about how they're almost thumbing our noses in it. And the thing that I found most fascinating about this ridiculous Charleston shooting was the hearing that was allegedly held, where Dylan Stormroof's 15-year-old brother got to dress up as a cop behind him, and the alleged judge stepped out and said, Charleston's a great city and terrible you've done this, and then allowed the alleged victims to tell Dylan Stormroof, without an attorney, how much they forgave him. What I'm wondering is, that was so absurd from a legal jurisprudence standpoint. Is it possible that they're literally setting themselves up to say, you know, if you believe this, what we threw out, then you're a bunch of idiots, just like whichever one in your book talked about?
Well, Angel, actually, the next story, which we see here in slide number 11, the Virginia TV shooting on 27 August, when we take a close look, in slide number 12, we see it being reported that a reporter and a photographer was shot to death on the air. Sounded very dramatic until you actually looked into the evidence, because as slide 13 shows, this was clearly a staged event. You have this 300-pound black guy walking up to them doing an interview on a wooden balcony. So you could hear his feet coming from the creaking of the wood. He waits until just the right moment, as though she weren't aware of his presence, then fires from virtually point-blank range, and there is no blood. She turns and runs off. And indeed, as the next slide shows, number 14, when you look at the area, the balcony from the air, you can see there's no blood there. This was another completely staged event. Nobody died here, and it turns out her father is an actor who's been an avid anti-gun proponent of long standing. It's embarrassing, Angel, that they're seeking to manipulate the public through these staged events.
Is there a goal of gun control? Well, that's what we think. But if it is it utterly backfiring because people are buying more guns, or are they just planning to take more away from more people? What do you think? Is it backfiring on them?
Yes, absolutely. It's backfiring because people can see the absurdity of it, which will become clear as we continue. The fact of the matter is that people need guns to defend themselves. It looks as though we may be on the verge of a war with Russia, in which case Washington and New York would be taken out immediately. Our government would collapse. If we did not have weapons, we'd be defenseless against marauding gangs who want to rape and loot and pillage. Even homeowners who have no weapons are defenseless against those who would break into their homes. It takes 20 minutes for the police on the average to respond to a call. But the carnage typically takes place in the first five, when your daughter could be raped, your wife could be mugged, you could be killed. So it's terribly important. And some law enforcement officials are now encouraging that citizens should be armed to protect themselves, because of considerations like those I'm outlining here.
It's the end of 2015 and headed toward 2016, and anybody in this movement with a brain like we have is recognizing that things seem to be coming to some sort of a head, that we're in for a very interesting year coming up. And I think it was Vivian Lee that said that they're actually making these false flag things so stupid as a demonstration of their power. It's a power trip. What do we do to the people that we know, that we show this to, that say, I don't want to see that. It's too much for me. What can we say?
Kevin, they are free to pursue their own pursuits, but they're sleepwalking through history. They have no idea what's going on around them. Just as the Umpqua College shooting on 1 October, which is the headline in slide number 15, demonstrated. Once again, as we see in slide 16, there was a lot of coverage. Oregon shooting at Umpqua College kills 10, sheriff said. According to the official account, and we see in slide number 17, we had a group of first responders who, knowing they were going to be on television, put on a T-shirt for their cause of the week, which in this case was Breast Cancer Awareness Week. You had no surge of ambulances. I mean, this is not displaying any urgency. Someone is lying on one of these portable, but there's no signs that anyone was actually killed. We're told officially that the shooter asked each student what their religion was, and if they said they were Christian, they were shot in the head. Well, this is another contrived event to, in this instance, instill fear into another segment of the population, namely Christians. And just as there are a lot of blacks in America, there are a lot of Christians. But as the next slide shows, this is number 18. Bottled water is a sure sign. We had bottled water all over the place. We had bottled water at Sandy Hook in the firehouse and boxes of pizza. We have bottled water here. That's a sure sign. What we're talking about is a drill, one more drill. Now, in this case, it's very interesting that the sheriff who is investigating the Oregon massacre published a Sandy Hook Truther video suggesting that he was skeptical about it, as we see on slide 19. And on slide 20, there was a very, very good article.
Nice.
13 troubling signs of potentially yet another false flag. Let me mention just a few before inviting your comments once again. On slide number 21, grandiose mainstream media headline demanding your attention to this story. Immediate call for gun control in the story headline. Obama himself immediately calls for gun control, seizing the moment, Sandy Hook style. And in slide 22, a few others. Initial images and videos show no ambulances, no blood, no dead bodies. The shooting has a divisive religious twist to it, opens a door for blaming Muslim and others later on. Angel, this was just another really poorly executed fake staged attack. Embarrassing on the whole.
As an actor and a director myself, I keep thinking about my poor fellow crisis actors, and I know we uncovered in the most recent San Bernardino shooting the Craigslist advertisement offering the acting jobs to the participants and saying they would have to sign a waiver. My question for you, Dr. Fetzer, is do you have any insight or information, either one, as to whether or not my poor fellow actors know ahead of time that they're going to be in on a total national scam, or whether they think they're in a drill that they then are put into a little room and said, okay, we're going live with this one, and you're all just as guilty as we are, if not. Do you any information on that for my poor actors out there?
Angel, there have been so many of these, and they've been so widely covered, especially in the alternative media. Unless we're dealing with zombies, this has to be a conscious, willing suspension of disbelief. In other words, they are willing to allow themselves to be cast as actors in these, regardless of the consequences. They're being paid for it. They're being given meals. In this stage of the economy in the United States, they're probably grateful for the work, but I'm sorry to say they have to have at least a lingering suspicion that they're playing a role in an elaborate charade intended to deceive the American people.
I'm not seeing lingering suspicions amongst anybody, least of all my fellow performers. I wish I were. I wish everybody had those lingering suspicions. Thank you for that. Let's keep going.
Well, let's turn to slide number 23, which identifies the second biggest story of the year, to wit that the book Nobody Died at Sandy Hook was published by Amazon on 22 October, but it did so very well, having sold nearly 500 copies by the 19th of November when it was banned by Amazon. On that same day, I released it as a PDF to the public for free. Kevin, Angel, I dare say, it's going to turn out this case will be studied by journalism classes in the future because it was a colossal blunder to ban the book. We might have sold 4,000 or 8,000 copies of the book, but now it's being downloaded and read by millions. If you look at the next slide, number 24, it turns out Amazon had 20 books on Sandy Hook, but only one of them drew conclusions that disagreed with the government, and that, of course, was the book that was banned. It had many five-star ratings from those who'd actually read the book, one-star readings from those who had not. But there are 13 contributors to the book, Angel, and they include 6 PhD, current or retired college professors, where the evidence we produce is simply overwhelmingly compelling. Look, for example, in slide number 25. We have a photograph from the Nancy Lanza bedroom suite where Adam is supposed to have shot his mother to death lying on the bed. There's some red stuff there, but it's clearly not blood. It's not in copious quantity. I suspect it might be raspberry jam. There are some white papers on the wooden chest, which we find in many other photographs because they were keeping records of precisely how they were furnishing each room of the house to serve as a prop. And notice beneath the left leg of the bed, in their haste, they forgot to remove a blue moving pad. In the case of the refurbishing of the school, in Chapter 8, we have yet another 50 photographs, among which this is by far the most stunning, where the SWAT team is already present. Above the vehicle, you can see a string of four windows that have not been damaged yet. Although during the presumptive shooting, the second from the left especially would be shot out. You have the flag at full mast. You have crime scene tape up for a crime that is yet to be committed. And beneath the flag was Wayne Carver, medical examiner, awaiting the arrival of his portable tent. In slide number 26, you have a close-up view where it's more easy to see Wayne Carver is there, because he would be the key official from the state of Connecticut who would make the whole story hang together, even though there were many gaps and gaffes in his press conference that raised suspicions from, for example, the extremely capable journalism professor at Florida Atlantic University, James Tracy, who published a brilliant article raising questions about Sandy Hook because of the dismal performance of Wayne Carver, which was the first serious scholarly article about Sandy Hook. In the next slide, number 27, you can see the windows undamaged at the top left. You can see the windows after they're damaged on the top right. On the lower left, you can see the perps actually drilling the holes in the window frame that were intended to simulate gunshots. And in the lower right, you can see when they introduced pink rods to simulate the trajectories that are all perfectly parallel. They're all 90 degrees to the window, and from the inside shooter's location, they're all uniformly 55 degrees in relation to the shooter's angle to the window. This is completely contrived, and in some of the photographs, you can see where the aluminum peels out into the classroom, which, of course, is precisely the opposite had this been a bona fide shooting. This is as important evidence as you could have in a case like this, that it was elaborately staged. But there is a development here, as seen in slide number 29, namely, we have been able to find a new printer and a new distributor, and the book has now been made available at moonrockbooks.com, where, look at the cover on the left, Angel, I added a badge to this book. It states, banned by Amazon.com 2015.
Nice. Now, I know that you have 50 slides and you're concerned about time, but we're 30 slides in at 18 minutes, so I think you might have a little bit of time to talk about, to explore this a little bit, because this is really, I think, one of the seminal moments in truth history is your book and what's happened to it and the reaction to it. One of the things that happened was that InfoWars, the most popular alleged truth site in the world, the controlled opposition, Alex Jones, Bill Hicks's new incarnation, they published that photograph that you showed, and there was a big to-do about it, but then it got taken down and removed from Google cache. What, in your considered opinion, what's going on with this controlled? I mean, Jones seems to have done so much good in so many areas. Other people that we know and used to care about seem to have done so much good in so many other areas. Can you comment on either on what's going on or what we can do about this the strange divisiveness? Is everybody a shill but you and me? What's up?
Let's go back to slide number 26 then, so we see what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Interestingly, when the article was published on InfoWars, and what could be more thematic with the InfoWars, the idea of information warfare, than a book that blows apart the basis for the Obama administration's gun control agenda, than this should, and that it should be banned. where they obtained an even better version of this photograph, which they published in the article at the top. But stunningly, Angel, it had a photo credit to the Connecticut State Police, which meant that it was in and of itself definitive evidence that the Connecticut State Police were aware that a scam was taking place and that they were principal players in the scam. Because as you see, again, I reiterate, those four windows are undamaged, whereas we know now, and we can move back to slide number 28, it's seriously damaged when we look after the shooting, but it's all been staged. So this is a fascinating development. The article appears to have been up for 38 minutes. It already had 178 comments, Angel, and then it was taken down. In fact, they were so stunned by this development that they had a better version they were attributing to the Connecticut State Police. They've even purged it from the internet cache, so you can't even find it using the Wayback Machine today. However, fortunately, it had already been captured and retained, and I published the article in one of my blogs.
What's going on? What's their agenda? I mean, for heaven's sake, is it really true that Alex Jones is like, you know, just complete controlled opposition and has some big agenda? Is he halfway there? Gordon Duff, I mean, it seems like Veterans Today had some good stuff, but then you got too close to certain things. What, for heaven's sake, something's going on, and if we can't figure it out, Jim, who can?
Well, Angel, those are very good questions that ought to be addressed to Alex Jones and to Gordon Duff, it seems to me.
Come on, my show, either one of you.
I'm no mind reader. I can only tell you based upon their behavior that Alex Jones doesn't want to talk about Israeli complicity in 9/11. Gordon Duff did not want to talk about Jade Helm, which I thought was extraordinary because it was causing so much concern within the community in general. And yet, after he had chastised a contributor to Veterans Today for publishing on Jade Helm, declaring it was an ordinary training drill, I published an article explaining why it was obvious it was not an ordinary training drill. And the following day, Gordon Duff took me out of Veterans Today. Very disturbing, in my opinion.
Veterans
Day. Gordon does a lot of good work, but I'm afraid that the classic mix of accurate information to false information by professionals that disinformation is 80 to 20. In other words, they give you 80% good stuff and 20% bad mixed in with it.
Wow.
And without being definitive about it, I think you could apply those measures to Alex Jones and to Gordon Duff alike.
Okay, well, I don't pay attention to Alex Jones, but since I was working with you when the kerfuffle at Veterans Today happened, I have paid close attention to Veterans Today. And what I believe I have seen is the Jade Helm was a cover for him burying your information about these false flags, because he doesn't talk about them anymore except an occasional, very quick article by Kevin Barrett, which then just gets buried in his stuff. It's not, and the headline is sort of skewed, but see, Alex Jones is not mentioning Israeli complicity in 9/11, but that's all that Gordon Duff talks about. So I'm just at a loss to try and figure out what is going on.
It was shocking to me when he not only took me off of Veterans Today, but subsequently deleted all 150 articles I'd published for Veterans Today beginning in 2011.
Yes.
When he first invited me to join as a journalist. And, you know, it caused such consternation. They took a tremendous hit to their readership that about 6 weeks later, the editorial board voted to have them restored. And Gordon, it appears, thwarted that by having little software robots defeat making copies of any of the articles. When I complained to the general manager, that ceased, and I've finally been able to regain access to the articles, where I've moved 70 of the 150 already to jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. You can find the most of them on three consecutive days, October 28th, October 29th, and October 30th. Now, if we return to these increasing false flag, look at slide number 30. We have the Paris terrorist attack of the 13th of November. And It's very difficult for Americans to wrap their minds around the possibility that these fake attacks are occurring abroad as well as at home. But where slide number 31 reflects how artificial it is, if you look at the pattern of what's supposed to be blood, and if it's real blood, I suspect it's animal blood that has been mopped on the floor. Look, it's in either the shape of a heart or the shape of a figure eight. Yeah. These don't appear to be real bodies. Notice none of those bodies is actually exuding any blood itself.
Yeah.
But that would necessarily be the case if they'd actually been shot. And if you look at
Jim, hold on, because I do have to say my fun little piece about this one. Because if you look on the stage, all of the musicians' equipment has been broken down. When you look at the interviews of the band that was allegedly there, they talk about having run for their lives in the middle of everything. So it means that if you've ever seen a drum set broken down, ladies and gentlemen, it's a long and involved process. Don't ever take up the drums. But somehow he had to take down his drum set and remove his equipment while all those poor people were lying there dead on the floor.
Angel, that's a brilliant observation. I appreciate that tremendously. Yeah. Just look at those bodies. You see any blood exuding from any of those bodies?
Yeah.
No, you don't. These appear to be dummies that were staged and arranged. Even more telling is the fact that we had a tweet about the Paris attack 2 days before the event, and Wikipedia published an elaborate article about the Paris terrorist attacks in advance that had as many as 20 different references. One of the classic blunders akin to Jane Stanley of the BBC reporting the destruction, the collapse of Building 7, 23 minutes before it actually happened on 9/11, from which the BBC has never recovered. And then as slide number 33 reflects, it turns out that there was a drill taking place at the same time, and yet another report about the head of the CIA meeting with the head of French intelligence in advance of the event, no doubt to coordinate, where we finally, as slide number 34 reflects, had ISIS claiming responsibility for the Paris attacks as revenge for Syrian airstrikes and for insulting Islam's prophet. But the Syrian airstrikes were not being conducted by the French. They were being conducted by the Russians. And the fact is, we already have discovered that ISIS was created by the United States. So the levels of deceit and deception here, Angel, are simply staggering.
They really are. And France, or Paris at least, has been under martial law, the suspension of all of the civil liberties that everyone warns us are going to be suspended here in the United States, or that somebody wants to be suspended here in the United States. Boy, you hear so many different ideas about, and you said you're not a mind reader, of course not. You're an evidence-based person, I appreciate that. But somehow we've got to get into not just the heads of the people that are doing this and the heads of the people that are subjected to this, and see what we can come up with to find the solutions. Or, in fact, we are going to have the same, another false flag attack that's large enough and crazy enough for them to do the imposition of martial law here in the United States.
Well, I do think that they're working up toward that, Kevin, and the latest effort here is shown by slide number 35, namely the San Bernardino shooting, which we have, of course, also covered before on this very program.
Yeah.
But look at slide number 36, you know, the official report in the New York Times about the shooting. A couple is supposed to have killed 14 people, left 21 wounded. Thousands of rounds of ammunition. Obama or officials were reluctant to describe it as a terrorist attack. Look at the vehicle. It turns out this appears to be a police vehicle. There are a lot of holes in the windshield, but there are no holes in the chassis. Not even the tires are shot out. They claim there was a running gun battle with the terrorists, but the window was rolled up. You can't have a running gun battle if the windows of your vehicle are rolled up. And when the purported bodies were taken out of the vehicle, they were handcuffed.
Yeah.
How could terrorists have been conducting a running battle if they were handcuffed? And indeed, it turns out when you zoom in on the bodies that the face has been photoshopped and appears, in fact, to be another dummy, a new kind of dummy that can display gore. And if we look at slide number 37, I mean, how much more indication of fraud could we have here? and the Craigslist advertisement
there it is.
For extras needed with good pay. Need 30 people, 21 to 70, to do background work on Wednesday, December 2nd. Call in 6 a.m. Tuesday, December 1st for the Wednesday shoot. Location in Highland, California in San Bernardino. Casual dress, plain clothes, office attire, food provided, and busing. You got to sign a waiver that you won't talk about it under penalty of perjury. And then we find in slide number 38 that the Obama administration is maintaining that the terrorist attacks will subside when we pass more gun control laws. Honest, Angel, this is the most loopy claim I've ever heard from the office of the White House. This is completely absurd to suppose that if you pass more gun laws, terrorist attacks are going to subside. If there were a causal relationship there, it would only be because they've been putting on all these fake terrorist attacks in order to bring about gun control, so that once they achieve their objective, they'll no longer have to stage so many fake attacks.
I know you're not a mind reader. I know you're an evidence-based professor of learning. But what do you, and all of you have looked at, what's the end game? Do they want our guns for why? So that the banksters can continue fiat currency once people wake up, so they can shut down the internet, so they can enslave people and take our vital fluids? I mean, what's going on?
Angel, this is typical of a scenario where you don't possess the information they possess. They may know, for example, the economy is going to collapse because of mismanagement by Congress and the president. They don't want the American people to be the position to take out their anger on the Congress and the president by shooting them up. They don't want the American people to be capable of standing up for themselves when they betray the country. I think that the problem with your hypothesis is they know the game they're playing, and we simply have to do the best we can to sort it out. The point of the matter is there's no scenario under which taking guns away from the American people is beneficial. Indeed, one of the reasons I believe they suppressed Nobody Died at Sandy Hook is because I included as an appendix a study showing that when guns are banned, crime goes up. In other words, all we've been told by the Obama administration turns out to be false. It's even the case, Angel, that there's been a reduction in violent crimes in the United States over the past decade and a half.
What do you say to their argument that in Scotland, only 20% of the cops carry weapons and everything's all peachy dandy in those countries that don't have weapons? What's your response to that?
You got to look at the evidence. I even published a study in the book. Now, they're going to be selective and try to pick a case that makes their case, but that's called special pleading. It's like a used car salesman trying to convince you that the car's got a great stereo, it's got a wonderful upholstery, and ignoring the fact that it needs a ring job and the engine is shot. Yeah. It's typical kind of propaganda we find from used car salesmen, editorial writers, and politicians. Now, if we go further,
one more thing. There also is the case that in all these other countries, Australia, England, wherever the cops only carry billy clubs or whatever, they are not the most powerful country in the world. They are not the United States of America. They are not the one with the greatest resources and the best military might and a hidden shadow government operating, you know, advanced
Angel,
technology.
If you look deeper into the evidence, it appears that crime goes up everywhere they ban guns.
Everywhere.
So, you know, this is not
really
a superficial phenomenon.
Okay.
Now, if we look at slide number 39, you mentioned, you know, divisions within the community. One of the most sensational developments in relation to 9/11 research has been the emergence of a woman by the name of Rebecca Roth, who has a book entitled Methodical Illusion, in which she accounts for what happened to the planes and the passengers, so that there's an explanation for all those phone calls that we know cannot have been made from planes, because air phones won't work at speeds above 200 miles an hour, altitudes above 2,000, and where A.K. Dewdney, the professor of computer science at Western Ontario, and David Ray Griffin, the dean of 9/11 studies, have both demonstrated all those phone calls were fabricated or faked. Well, Rebecca offers a story that, in my judgment, is intended to weave a narrative around the data points we have about all four of the alleged crash sites having been fabricated or faked in different ways to bring back the planes, even though we have Bureau of Transportation statistics records showing that Flight 11, North Tower, and 77, the Pentagon, were not even in the air that day. We have FAA registration records showing that Flight 93, Shanksville, and 175, South Tower, those planes used for those flights were not even deregistered or taken formally out of service until 28 September 2005. So how can planes that were not even in the air have crashed on 9/11? And how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? If you look at the next...
Are you saying there were never any crews or people to have gotten rid of, that no, that there weren't any planes at all? So her story about them being in a hangar somewhere instead of, you know, in the air because of the things they said to her is complete. Nobody died on planes, is what you think?
Nobody died on planes, Angel. None of the planes crashed. And Pilots for 9/11 Truth, by virtue of a study of air ground communications, was able to establish that Flight 93, for example, was over Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, after it had purportedly crashed in Shanksville. And the Flight 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had purportedly hit the South Tower. It's all a sham.
So the death lists of the planes, they weren't real. There were no planes at all for there to even be passengers that were telling a phony story.
Angel, you're not listening to me. Flights 93 and 175 were real planes that were really in the air, but they did not crash in Shanksville. They did not hit the South Tower. Pilots have demonstrated that the Shanksville plane was over Champaign, Illinois, Urbana, Illinois, after it had allegedly crashed in Shanksville. That 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had officially hit the South Tower. And with the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, own registration records, which I obtained, show that those two planes, the planes used for those flights, were not deregistered or formally taken out of service until 28 September 2005, 4 years later.
Well, you and I have been in this movement for a long time, and what about the, she really did those pictures of the art students and the floor 93 work and the balcony and the helicopter and all that. I mean, that was really new to me. Did she really come up with that, or?
Angel, let me proceed, and then
okay.
We can talk about
Sounds
it.
Sounds good.
If we look at slide number 40, it turns out that Rebecca Roth bears an uncanny resemblance to Monica, Monica, who is on a show called The Fix Your Health Teams with a fellow named Michael, where she was promoting a wonder salve called Immortelle, reportedly capable of solving 17 different kinds of ailments from autism to spinal injury. She has the same voice as Monica, the same verbal inflections, the same coquettish manner in speech, the same laugh. If you look at... If you look at number 41, when you take Monica and put Rebecca's wig and glasses on, then we have a stunning resemblance to Rebecca, who has denied being Monica to the current radio network that carries her show.
Nice.
But where, as we see in frame number 42, Rebecca is now going after the 9/11 truthers who have exposed that she's not a flight attendant. She's making a statement to look out for anyone who attacks her and flag their website, because three flags will close your YouTube account. The man speaking on the video sounds very similar to the man on her health that Fix Your Health misspelled here. The video is a comment from 2 hours ago. Rebecca Roth, thanks, Scott. These trolls are really showing themselves to be working for the enemy of American freedom. Please email me any names you come up with, and if you see their BS videos, flag them as creating violence or bullying. But that's not what these studies are done. They're simply exposing that she's a phony and a shill, that she's been lying to us. And if you can see it here, very revealing, at the back of her book, Methodical Illusion, I'll read it to you.
Okay.
A special thanks to my husband for his patience and understanding through my numerous hours of research, and for knowing how important this book was for me to both research and to write, and to the Fix Your Health team with doTERRA for your products to keep me creative, healthy, and uplifting. It even appears it even appears that the Michael on her health show is the same person called Ramjet on her news show. They have the same manner, the same appearance, and the same voice. I now believe that Rebecca and Michael are not merely friends and associates and colleagues, but actually married.
Wow. Wow. Okay. What about her new, that evidence? Had you ever seen that before? The art student pictures and the floor 93 and all that? That was
There's a lot about what she does that I like. In fact, I showed before, if we can go back to slide number 39, I published an initial article about her on the 21st of September on my blog, Rebecca Roth's Methodical Illusion Pros and Cons. Then on the 5th of November, a second, that Rebecca's Methodical Illusion may be Rebecca herself. Then on the 20th of November, Alan Powell from Australia wrote a fiction, writing fiction about a fiction. And on December 10th, we did an hour show exposing Rebecca, playing the audio tapes that show it's the same woman with the same voice and so forth. Rebecca Roth Exposed, which you can find on YouTube, has created a sensation. And since then, I've done more on Rebecca, including a two-hour program with Scott Bennett and Michael Jay and Alan Powell on Truth Unite, which is Carrie Cassidy's channel. So you want to find Truth Unite about Rebecca Roth. It's the most thoroughgoing and detailed critique of who she is and what she's doing. Now, what's good about Rebecca Angel is she talks about Israeli complicity. She talks about the Gelatin Group, which were a small number of some 200 Mossad agents that came into the United States on the pretext of being art students. The Gelatin Group deserves a great deal more attention. They were conducting performance art on the outside of the Twin Towers. I believe it was they who set up for the creation of the cutouts that were supposed to be the effects of real planes hitting the building when no real planes hit the building. But they created the cutouts using what I believe was probably even thermite, possibly even nanothermite, which is non-explosive, but generates extremely high temperatures. It has a dazzling capability of melting steel. So I believe that's how they were created. But in the process, she is ignoring the fact that there was a complete stand down by the American Department of Defense, that there were some 47 drills, as Webster Tarpley has exposed. So she's trying to divert all the attention to Israel. I think it's commendable. There's a website out there entitled Israel Did 9/11, All the Proof in the World Every Serious Student of 9/11 Needs to Review, because Israeli complicity was overwhelming and comprehensive. But it was brought to us jointly by the CIA, the neocons in the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. And what Monica does, what Rebecca does, is obfuscate all of that and restores the planes and passengers in order to create some greater semblance of plausibility to the official account.
Let's keep going. Thank you.
A quite startling development has just occurred, as in slide 43 reflects. I mentioned James Tracy.
No.
The first serious scholar to author an article in that case about Wayne Carver and his bizarre press conference. He's been given a notice of termination by Florida Atlantic University. If you see the next slide, number 44, the Daily News even published prematurely that he's been fired for harassing parents of Sandy Hook. This is by Lenny Posner and his wife, Veronique. It's a completely shocking and wrong and a major article.
When did this happen? Yesterday?
Yes. This is a major development. He's actually been given a two-week notification of termination. A Jewish publication in Florida named Forward published an article, an attack by Lenny Posner on James Tracy. I submitted a rebuttal to Forward as follows. Let me read it.
Yes.
Are you all gullible saps? Are you knowingly accessories after the fact to the monumental scam known as Sandy Hook? Are you unaware that Lenny Posner gave a copy of Noah's death certificate to Kelly Watt, which turned out to be a fabrication, and that Noah died twice? Once at Sandy Hook on 14 December 2012, then again in Pakistan on 16 December 2014, or that Lenny Posner has made it his life's work to undermine the mountain of proof that Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax because he and his wife have pocketed well over $1 million in donations from sympathetic Americans who have given him money? Nobody died at Sandy Hook 2015, which has 13 contributors, including six PhD current or retired college professors, provides 425 pages of proof that the school had been closed by 2008. It was a two-day FEMA drill with a rehearsal on the 13th, going live on the 14th. We even have the manual, which I made an appendix to the book. Paul Preston, an LA school safety expert, was so disturbed by what he saw on television that he reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, who confirmed that it had been a drill, that no one had died, and that it was done to promote gun control. When the book was banned, I released it to the public for free as a PDF. It has had millions of downloads. I am stunned that Forward should be so backward as to be ignorant of the sensation this has caused. We're banning books by Amazon.com is comparable to burning books by the Nazis. Something needs to be done to stop the lies and deceit and deception by monstrous liars like Noah and Veronique Posner, who are playing you for saps, using the name Noah in lieu of Lenny. I was astonished when this initially appeared, and they immediately took it down, claimed it would be waiting for approval, but then suppressed it. So I published the following when I discovered what had happened. So Forward will publish lies by a Jew, Lenny Posner, but suppress a response that exposes them from a non-Jew, Jim Fetzer, even though he, meaning me, is attacked in the article you published. I have never before taken seriously the Talmudic dictum that Jews are allowed to lie to Goyim, but that would appear to be the policy of Forward. Count me as a disillusioned Goyim who is not going to place any faith in a Jewish publication in the future. This journal is propaganda.
Holy cow.
Oh, wow.
Holy cow.
It's something else.
Let's finish up. So we have a few more minutes. Yeah. Let's finish your slides, and then we can talk. We'll finish our minutes.
All right. Here we have just a few more slides about 2015 in retrospect, as slide 47 shows. Kurt Russell has picked up the issue about gun control and taken on a reporter who turns out to be brainwashed in favor of gun control. As you see in the next slide, number 49, the reporter whose name is Wells, what's he going to do? I guess he's going to beg to have his guns taken away so he can be even more helpless against shooters and terrorists. Then when one shows up, he'll run and go hide in a closet and cower in fear, waiting for the government authorities to come save him, like the DHS active shooter guide suggests. Wells tries to counter by mumbling something about, but the San Bernardino shooters. But just come on, what a big fat bag of logic fail. The San Bernardino guns were purchased legally, and the shooting itself happened where? That's right, in yet another gun-free zone. None of the gun control executive orders Obama is about to pass without congressional approval would have stopped what happened. And is in fact, as you are well aware, Angel, he signed executive orders just a month and 2 days after Sandy Hook, 23 of them by actual count. Banning people on the no-fly list from being able to purchase guns implies, A, terrorists actually wait to jump through legal loopholes to purchase firearms before committing acts of terror, and B, that the list is even accurate considering it's been reported that there are even 18-month-old babies on there. But hey, if there's any silver lining to the fact that the Second Amendment is under further attack, at least then the 72 Department of Homeland Security employees on the terrorism watch list won't be able to get their hands on a gun either. And if you look at the final slide, number 50, what Kurt Russell has observed is that anyone who believes that the terrorist attacks will stop when we pass more gun control laws is literally insane. And I agree with him 100%. I use this last slide to sum up the year we have been living through because it's explaining why stage shootings. The government resorts to stage shootings and crisis actors. It's to keep better control of the story. After 9/11, real people died. Four wives of husbands who had been killed on 9/11, known as the Jersey Girls, exerted pressure on the Bush-Cheney administration, forced them to appoint a 9/11 commission, which they resisted doing for 441 days. When they went to testify themselves, they insisted it not be under oath, that no notes be taken, and that they be allowed to testify together. You would have thought you were interrogating a couple of mafia dons. The government has found they can control the story better if they use actors who are paid. They can control the message, and they don't have danglers such as the relatives of dead people who are pursuing all kinds of issues that the government cannot control. It's a sad story, but that's the message of the year we've just been living through, 2015.
The documentary about the Jersey Girls is called Press for Truth. There's another great documentary out lately called Incontrovertible, aimed at firefighters, policemen, and soldiers. If you haven't seen, it's time to talk about Sandy Hook or any of Sophia Smallstorm's work. The evidence is complete out there. You've mentioned a few names, and since we are so surrounded by these, I could talk to you for hours, Jim, about so many things. Since we're so surrounded by people that are only partially telling us the truth. You mentioned Alan Powell, Scott Bennett, and was it Michael Jay?
Yes.
Alan Powell, Scott Bennett, Michael Jay, who else would you recommend that we pay attention to and that you personally trust as we go forward in 2016? Anyone else?
Oh, Angel, that's a tough call. You know, it's not like there's a superabundance out there. I do recommend Sophia Smallstorm. I think she's simply excellent. I do recommend Wolfgang Halbig. I do recommend others in the 9/11 movement. I highly recommend James Tracy.
Oh, God.
Although he's being pilloried,
that
he has
news.
Shown great courage and integrity, and for that he has been savaged. So get the irony. Here you have Rebecca Roth being lionized, even though she's marketing lies on a large scale. And James Tracy, who has been speaking the truth, is being condemned and punished. It's an outrage and injustice, and reveals the Orwellian world we're living in which the false is true, black is white, and there's no justice at all for those who are doing the best to bring it to the American people.
Dr. James Tracy of memoryholeblog.com, I cannot even tell you how distressing that news is to me. I have been following his website for a long time, and the concept that Tenure would be destroyed and the academic thinkers could be subjected to the whims of these monsters. I'm sorry, those of you who are out there that are a part of this giant scam on the American people, unfortunately you are caught up in a horrible system, and you do not want to continue. This is a Frankenstein monster, and it will turn on its creator. That is absolutely assured. Dr. James Fetzer, as always, I am so grateful that you are there. You're somebody that I do trust, who is of integrity. There have been some other developments today that you didn't want to talk about. I look forward to talking with them. And you've invited me on your show, The Real Deal, with James Fetzer. Don't miss it. JamesFetzer.blogspot.com and James Tracy's memoryholeblog.com. And we have Alan Powell, Scott Bennett. Stay tuned. Ladies and gentlemen, 2016 is going to be a really interesting year, and we'll be there to watch it with you.
Special thanks to you, Angel, and to Don, too. I think his shows are making a difference. I'm very glad to be here.
We are very honored to have you be on them. I'm honored to be here.
Okay, and we'll close with our little theme song here. Okay.
I was out when you said 353, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. You meant 9 minutes, but you said 8 in case I went over, right?
Yeah,
you forget
that. We can do it.
I'm on time.
Yes, we can.
They like our banner, remember that?
We can change things throughout the land. But we are
mugs.
Lend a hand.
It's going.
We can do it. Oh, yes.
Thank you, everybody. Stay tuned.
Oh, your neighbor.
It's been quite a year here, folks. And so,
A bit bewildered. Hopefully we'll have a better year and things will be looking up as we take control, as we get the word out here. Thank you so much.
Know what to do. Join together and then there'll be two. There are others all around, scattered throughout the town. Reach out and you will see your numbers swell to three.
We can do it, yes we can. We can change things throughout the
say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22nd, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets. Turn them off now. Turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Hi, this is the Real Deal with Larry Rivera tonight, speaking to you on the Real Deal for Jim Fetzer, Professor Fetzer, And tonight I have a very special program with a witness, an eyewitness for the November 22nd for the assassination. And this is what I would call a pristine and uncontaminated witness. There are very few of these left. Today, at 69 years old, he is a happily married, religious man who cherishes the time that he spends with his 24 grandchildren. From what I could perceive and witness, he has great relationships with his neighbors, as I saw him warmly greeting them outside of his middle-class, well-kept home. After the assassination and the perfunctory attempts to contact him by the FBI, he slipped into oblivion, and nobody had ever taken the time or made the effort to investigate what he saw and heard on November 22, 1963. In 1998, Larry Sneed interviewed him for his book and wrote one of the chapters on him. However, Sneed did not go that much into detail that I have gone into with this witness. He has never read the Warren Commission report or any information contained in the 26 volumes of exhibits and hearings. He has never read any books or been interested in the aftermath of the assassination of President Kennedy. It is obvious to this researcher that he had never seen any of the images which depict him at the entrance of the Texas School Book Depository, such as the Alton Six, all of the Wigman slides, including Wigman slide 658, and others, and Willis slide number 7. He has readily identified himself in these images. The church where he is a member, the congregation where he is a member of his church there, considers him a celebrity because they know that he knew Lee Harvey Oswald. However, that is where it ends. At the beginning of our conversation, I asked my witness to try to recall the events to the best of his ability, and I submitted 27 questions for him to answer. I found this man to be extremely lucid, sober, almost to a fault. The revelations that this man has to offer indeed will make investigators, researchers, and historians rewrite some of the accepted conclusions put forth by the Warren Commission and those who insist on supporting its fairy tale. Some of these conclusions are that Wesley Frazier arrived every day with Lee Oswald, not just on weekends. That's just one example. Now, this would indicate one of two things. Either that Frazier would pick him up at Oak Cliff on his way in from Irving, or that Lee Oswald never really stayed at Earlene Roberts' rooming house and always stayed with Ruth and Michael Payne in Irving. Okay. Now, we have never really been told how Lee Oswald arrived on a daily basis at the TSBD while living at Oak Cliff. And the police car beeping its horn outside of Earlene Roberts' house on 1026 North Beckley seems to be pretty solid. Also, Roberts' testimony about witnessing Lee going into his room at 1 p.m. that day. The most probable option has to be the first one, that Frazier probably picked them up there every day. Now, this witness has confirmed my ongoing thesis that Frazier would park his car at Houston and Ross and drop Lee off at the northeast corner of the building, never down by the railroad track south of the state building, especially on November 22nd when it had been raining in the morning. Most importantly, without ever seeing Edward Shields' HSCA interview, my witness has confirmed exactly what Shields testified, and we're going to include part of the transcript here tonight for you to read. A second revelation has to do with the supposed work going on the sixth floor, supposedly refurbishing the flooring that day and that week. I don't want to give it away, but there are very important revelations on that we're going to present here tonight. Another thing has to do with the sniper's nest and when exactly was that sniper's nest constructed up there. Okay. A fourth item that we're going to cover tonight has to do with the method of payment of the TSPB warehouse employees. It has been put forth by the Warren Commission, especially by Bill Shelley and Oshas Campbell, that these workers were paid strictly in cash. We have found out that this was not true, and we'll be explaining that later on today, tonight. Another thing that this witness has confirmed for me has been when exactly the TSPD company started to operate at 411 Elm Street. He started working there in August of 1962, and at the time, they were already operating on 411 Elm Street. There has been research done by some particular researchers that have revealed or postulated that the TSPD company had just recently moved into the location of 411 Elm Street, which was owned by David Harold Byrd, the building, during the summer of 1963. Okay, now, the other thing that we spoke about with this African-American witness, he's African-American, had to do with how they interacted amongst themselves in the aftermath of the assassination. I believe that this has never, ever been touched upon by researchers. And it's very important because as a minority group, the African-American workers and the witnesses, including those on Elm Street, were never actually interviewed or they were never asked about their impressions about what happened there on Elm Street on November 22nd. And these workers, actually, they talked amongst themselves. It was a perfectly natural thing to do. Now, the last thing that we did was we showed our witness the overlays on the man in the doorway. We reviewed our paper showing how the calibration of the system, which we have covered here in previous shows, and how the animations work on, and we used a laptop computer, and our witness, when he saw this, he was very, very impressed and surprised. And without much ado, let's start with, I first have an MP3 audio, which is an introduction, asking our witness to introduce himself and to give us his background. And then we have a small presentation with video and some images that go along with the interview. Okay, James, take it away.
Okay, first of all, I told you about my background. Okay, and I'm the chairman of the Oswald Innocence Campaign.
Okay.
Do you have your copy in case?
Yeah.
So okay,
yes,
that,
yes,
yeah, it's
yes,
over
yes,
here.
Yes,
yeah, those
yes,
are the questions.
Yes,
yeah.
You want the, yeah, the yeah. intro.
Yeah, the introduction. Let's get that.
You don't have this.
Yeah, that's,
oh, I don't have it.
You
yeah.
can have that.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I can have it.
Okay.
Okay. Now, go ahead.
Okay, our organization, whose members span the globe and whose goal and purpose is to obtain full exoneration for Lee Harvey Oswald for the assassination of our 35th president, inasmuch as we believe, as many early researchers did, including...
Are you reading from this?
Yeah, including Jim Garrison. It's right
okay,
there.
Okay, now, what paragraph
right
are you?
I'm right here.
Okay, okay.
Jim Garrison, Harold Weisberg, Shirley Martin, and many others, that Lee Oswald, who was captured in the famous Alton 6 photograph, standing right there in the doorway watching the motorcade, and had absolutely nothing to do with the assassination. Currently, we have the honor and distinction of being the only organization that includes in our ranks first-generation Warren Commission critics and authors Mark Lane and Vincent Salandria. We are also honored to have such prominent scholars and authors as Professors David Rome, Ph.D. Gerald McKnight, Ph.D. Jim Fetzer, Ph.D., and author Phil Nelson, whose Fetzer alone JFK assassination courses at universities across the country. I myself have written and co-authored with Professor Fetzer numerous published articles on the assassination, and I'm currently the co-host of the weekly internet show The Real Deal with Jim Fetzer. Okay, now, this is Larry Rivera for The Real Deal, where today, December the 30th, 2015, I am in Dallas, in Texas, interviewing an actual witness to the events of November 22nd, 1963, at the Texas School Book Depository. My very special guest, Roy Edward Lewis. Roy, welcome to The Real Deal.
Roy Edward Lewis, he got it all, didn't he?
That's right. Roy, today I would like to share with you some of my research, which includes state-of-the-art computer enhancement enhanced images and overlays, audio recordings, etc. I would also like to share some documents with you which I would like you to examine for accuracy. However, before we begin, I would like you to please tell us a little bit about you and how you ended up working at for the Texas School Book Depository Company. It's all yours, Roy.
Okay. I got married when I was 15, almost 16. And my ex-wife and I went to school together for a whole year. Okay. And then that summer in 1962, I was going to come to Dallas and just work part time and go back to East Texas. I'm from Carthage, Texas, East Texas. You got all that right. Okay. Now, when I came to Dallas, couldn't find no job or nothing, so I had looked around, and so I don't know. I can't remember who told me about Texas School Book Depository. I can't even remember, but I know I went to work there. But I lied and put my age up. I told them I was 18. They didn't check my record.
Right.
So when I told them I was 18, well, okay, I did not go back to my, since I had a job making minimum wage and pretty good, and it was, I didn't go back to my hometown. I stayed there. I started working, I think it was summer of 1962. It was 61. I can't remember 61 or 62. 62. It was 62. Yeah, and I went to work. I stayed there and worked. I can't remember. I believe I stayed with my sister at the time. I didn't have an apartment. But anyway, I worked there. And I worked there from 62 on through to, I worked there during this assassination. We all black and white. We all worked there together. We all filled orders. We all went up on, had access to, go use the, had what they call a freight elevator.
Right.
That's how we fill our orders. You go up to it. We weren't allowed on the second floor. That's the office floor. So we weren't allowed there. We could go third, fourth, and fifth floor on up. Mm-hmm. Might have been six. Anyway, we filled orders on the floor. Mm-hmm. And once you go up and fill your orders, you would bring the orders down and put them on the floor, and James Drummer would check the orders.
Right.
And then they had a, do you have Piper?
Yeah, Piper.
Okay.
Yes.
Piper was a packer. Do you have Western?
Western.
West Wesley.
No. West Wesley. Well,
he was the most important guy, because him and Piper, they packed. He was an old man back then.
Okay. So,
I'm sure he didn't go by now, but
okay.
Yeah, he was. He used to call me Little Red because he would like to drink Johnny Walker Red,
mm-hmm.
And I would tease him about it. He used to call me Little Red. Yeah,
okay, okay.
And we worked. That's when he packed the Piper, and he would pack the orders.
Okay.
And then James Drummer would check the orders.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who Bill Shirley was supervised. I don't think he was. He just walked around and checked people, you know, make sure.
Okay, we'll talk more in detail of that.
But that's how I got started there. I put my age up in that summer 1962 because I needed a job, and my wife was expecting.
That's what I wanted to get into.
Yeah, what you want to get into? Okay.
Because I believe that you named your daughter Jacqueline.
I did.
And I obviously had to have been because of Jackie Kennedy.
No.
It had nothing to do with it?
I don't think they had anything.
I thought it might have been because the way it spelled out.
Well, now, you know, that's too far back. It could have been. I can't tell you that. Sure. I can't tell you. My ex might could tell you, but I can't tell you what that's reason why we named
maybe
it.
Maybe there was a coincidence, but I thought that was very touching, you know. I will now review 27 questions that in my research I have formulated over the past 2 years, and I only ask that you answer them to the best of your ability.
Okay.
Okay. Now, Roy, I realize that 52 years have passed, and since these events, I don't expect you to be precise in every aspect. Okay. However, any information that you may regard as unimportant might actually be important from my perspective and level of research, because it might tie into other relevant areas of interest. Okay?
Okay.
So, if let's start. You've already spoken about how long you worked at the TSPD company. Now, when did you leave? When did you leave the company? And under what circumstances did that happen?
I don't remember.
'65? Were you there for 2-3 years?
Now that part slipped me.
Okay, that's fine.
That part slipped. Thank you. Now that part did slip me. That's fine.
Okay, now.
I left, but I think it was either 66 or 60. Might have been 66.
66? Okay.
65 or 66 when I left. And I went to work for I can't remember the place out on Keast. What was the name of that place out on Keast? You ought to remember. No, I have to have my ex and remember that.
Okay, that's fine. Now, in Larry Steen's book, because he interviewed you for a book called No More Silence.
Right.
Remember that, Larry Steen?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I have the chapter here and everything in case we need to go back to it. But in that book, he said that you had been with the company since August or September 1962. However, a report from the Dallas Police Department states that you had only been there for 7 months.
No, that's a lie.
So Larry Sneed was
okay. That's wrong. I've been there.
So that's one of the main things.
Wait a minute. I started working in 1962. It was the summer of 1962.
That's right. So what Larry Sneed published was correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, because this document from the Dallas Police Department says that you had only been there for 7 months. So I just wanted.
Well, it depends on when they did that. Because I went to work.
No, they did this in February 18. This document is dated February 18, 1964. I'm going to leave it.
No, that's wrong. I had been working there for 2 years.
Right.
After 64, it had been 2 years.
Right. This is dated February 18, 1964.
No.
And it said you had been there for 7 months.
Well, maybe they may have been there 7 months in 62. Mm-hmm. I had been there only several months in 1962, but I don't know how they figure that.
Right. Well, in any case, I'm leaving the document.
It's I got
in,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So you can see exactly, you know, what it was.
I don't know how they got that business group.
Let's just eat and then we'll continue.
Okay.
All right. Can you describe how the African American community in general reacted to the assassination? I think we've very, very briefly spoken about this.
Here's the thing: when the CIA or the FBI was calling itself, kept interviewing all the people.
Right.
Well, they came to my apartment unit.
Okay.
But we was close-knit people.
Right.
Those people in my apartment pretend they didn't even know me.
Right.
Because they didn't know what white folks wanted with me.
That's right. I know. Well, that's I want to hear about it.
So, but now, if you really the FBI and you really want, you knock on every door to make sure. They didn't even come up and knock on my door to see if I was there.
Okay.
Now, the people downstairs, my good friends downstairs, told them they didn't know me. They didn't know no road, don't live there. But, so they took their word for it. They didn't even try to come find it. Now, if you the CIA and you the FBI and something like this is happening, you know I lived in there, you know I got my address, you would knock on every door. You would knock on every door and ask for me when you're president.
That's right.
I think you would.
That's right.
I mean, if you're good FBI, good CIA, if you really wanted this, if you really wanted me.
That's right.
So they'd make me look like we weren't important.
That's right. Do you feel that perhaps they were intimidated into silence or misrepresenting the official version of events? Was this like some type of maybe intimidation or that type of thing with the African American witnesses, or maybe that they just ignored them altogether?
I just believe they just ignored them. I don't think it was intimidation.
Okay.
No.
Okay. within the other African-American employees among you, did you guys talk about what had happened amongst yourselves and that kind of thing? Did you guys, like, exchange ideas and opinions?
Yeah, we did.
And you comment among yourselves, you know?
Yeah, we did.
About what happened and what you had experienced that day?
Go find them.
Do you recall any type of instance like that?
Yes, we talked about it. And actually, the first thing we thought about it was Lee Harrell. We figured he did it.
Because that's what was being parroted by the media.
No, not so much that.
Okay, that was our very first clip with our introduction with our very special guest, Roy Lewis. And our second clip that we're going to play for you contains images, and it's going to be very interesting because Roy goes into some of the issues regarding the assassination and what was going on there at the Texas School Book Depository on that day, including what was going on the sixth floor and the behavior of Buell, Wesley Frazier, among others. And I'm sure our audience is going to find this very, very interesting. So after we're done with the clip, then we'll join in and talk a little bit more in detail about Mr. Roy Lewis.
Let me say this first. The main guy that you know you really talk about is Wesley Frazier.
That's right.
Wesley Frazier used to pick up Lee Harvey Oswald every day.
That's right.
Oh, you record this, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
He would pick him up every day and bring him to work.
That's right.
Now, Edward Shields told the in an interview that he and other friends, co-workers, I'm talking about the black co-workers, that they saw Wesley Frazier drop Lee Oswald off in front of the building, right there on Houston.
That's what he said.
And that it wasn't that they both drove to the back in front of the state building, and then he got out with a package under his arm, and he walked in ahead of him, and Wesley Frazier stayed behind, which is the official record.
I don't know about that.
Now,
I don't know where he dropped him off at. I don't know.
Yeah, but what Edward Shields said that that's not what happened, that he dropped him off in front of the building because it had been raining that morning. He wasn't going to go and, you know, get wet and muddy.
Right,
Plus, you from over there back in front of the state building, you had to go over railroad tracks and everything, you know. And that doesn't make any sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So we have a problem with that. And when Edward Shields, you know, he's on the building, you know, then that right there tells us that Wesley, you know, resenting the truth as far as that, you know, where Lee Oswald was dropped off. You know, it's like you said, bring him in every morning. Remember, he would give him a ride because Lee Oswald stayed at his rooming house during the week, Okay, and he only gave him a ride on weekends when he'd go to Irving where his wife was staying with Ruth Payne. Now, on that morning, that Friday morning when he came in, supposedly, and this is what's in that report that I'm telling, Edward Shields said, look, you know, he dropped him off in front. I asked him, where's your friend? Wesley Frazier said, I dropped him. Okay, so that story of him, you know, them, you know, going all the way back to in front of the state building and then walking together and then Lee walking in front of him with the package under his arm, you know, might not be exactly what happened, you know. And like I said, you know, that Houston Street didn't go all the way through the way it does today.
Mm-hmm.
There was railroad tracks and there was mud and ruts and everything, you know. And it had been raining that morning. And so all that, you know, was muddy, mm-hmm. you know. So it doesn't make any sense, mm-hmm. you know, that he would, you know, go with him and get all muddy, you know, to get to work. And he supposedly is carrying a package, okay. So I just want you about Edward Shields since you just mentioned that you know him, you know, you know, and they make you aware that's the story. The official story is that they both walked together, not together, but he let him go in front, and then supposedly he was revving his engine because he was having battery problems, you know, and that doesn't make any sense to me because if you drive all the way from Irving, your battery is already charged by the Tronics and how cars work, you know.
So, my concept on that was that he let him out in the bag. That was my concept.
And then he went and parked.
And then he went and parked, right.
That's right.
Now, that's my concept.
That's right.
But I didn't see anything. I can't say because I wasn't eyewitness to it. But he put him out in the bag. He's always putting him out. Now, you said he only rode with him on weekend. He rode with him every day.
Really?
Monday through Friday.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know that.
And he would bring him. But he would only, he would let him out of the back door. That's what I'm going to tell you.
That's right.
He would let him out and come in the back together.
And another thing, he usually didn't park all the way back there, from what I understand. He used to park right there on Houston, on the bend of Houston. Okay, so
and
he... That's right. So he didn't stay, it seems, I mean, this is what I'm interpreting, only on that day. He parked all the way back there, supposedly, behind the railroad tracks in front of the state building. You know, when usually he always parked right there on the bend of Houston, you know, where it bended and turned into Ross Avenue.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, that does, you know, that's something that we've always been questioning, wondering how, you know. So, if you're saying that he never parked all the way, well, this is something that either they're making it up only on that day, you know. Parking all the way back there, you know, that seems kind of strange.
Yeah, it does.
Okay.
But now.
A lot has been written about the supposed refurbishing of the sixth floor, the floor itself, with plywood. Do you know anything about that?
No.
That they had been laying down new plywood because the floor, they had been removing old flooring and putting new floors, you know, like...
I don't remember seeing that.
But on that particular week, supposedly, Bill Shelley was supervising this floor-laying project up there on the sixth floor. That's what it's been written in the Warren Commission, and everybody considers that gospel, you know? Like, that was the case, you know. Now, I've studied a lot of photographs of the sixth floor, and I've never seen any tools up there. I've examined every photograph that there is available.
Okay. That particular day, all of us went up to that sixth floor.
Mm-hmm.
That particular day, there were boxes. I don't know if you got that in
there.
There were boxes stacked up.
Mm-hmm.
Were tall enough where you couldn't see.
Right.
But there was a hole open in there where somebody could have been sitting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got as close as, and when I thought about it, it scared me, because if Lee Harvey or anybody else that was over in there,
You couldn't see him.
You couldn't see him. But if you had disturbed him, you would have got shot.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. But I got as close to that wall.
So there could have been more than, you know, the way the barricade, you're talking about a barricade, the barricade that was set up there.
Maybe could have been.
What time was the last time that you were up there on that day that you recall? 11, 10:30?
No. I don't know what time it was, but, you know, I went up there. It was pretty late. And see, I was like this. That particular day, everybody was anxious. I wasn't so much when I came out. The last thing I remember seeing was this impression of hair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But back to the floor, yeah. I want to know that I went up there and that stack was already up there.
Mm-hmm.
Barricade or whatever you want. Yeah.
Oh, so you saw a barricade before?
Before what?
Before the assassination. Is that
what it was already there.
Oh.
The stacks of books was already there. Stacked in there.
What they call the sniper's nest.
It was already set.
What time would that have been? 7:30, 11?
11:30, somewhere like there.
Yeah. It's interesting.
It could have been 10:30, but anyway, it was already there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was already there.
You know, that's very important. That's extremely important.
Well, that's why I said, because whoever was there, I got as close to.
How heavy were those boxes? Textbook, 55 pounds?
Oh, they were different. Yeah, at least that, 55 pounds.
Mm-hmm. You needed a little hand truck, right, to move them around? Did you use a hand truck?
You had each floor had its own stack. They had a line of books here and a line of books over there. So if he were close enough to those books, he could just stack them up. He wouldn't have to have a...
Mm-hmm.
Or he could have had a dolly, but he really didn't have to have
I was talking.
Hand dolly to stack them up.
Right.
Yeah, many as it was, I guess it could have been a hand.
Mm-hmm.
And now I said many as it were, I don't know how many were. All I knew was stacked.
Right.
Stack.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on then here. Then the refurbishing, so then you don't know if African Americans workers, Piper, West, Givens, Jarman, Williams, or Norman were involved in this refurbishing. You don't know if any of them were involved in that. Because that's one of the main things. That's really important because they're saying that sixth floor that crew was up there, and the reason they were up there is because they were laying down the new plywood. They were putting plywood on top of the old flooring, you know. And that, you know, you need carpenters to do that. It's been like that, you know, because you have to cut plywood to, you know, to measure up, you know, to the areas and everything. That's something a carpenter would have to do, not an order filler, you know.
I don't think that's for 6 foot and all that. Not at that particular time.
Okay. All right. Well, that's important. That's very important.
If it did, it eludes my mind. I don't remember that. Mm-hmm. I don't remember them doing that.
Well, it's like I said. I've examined every photograph of the 6 foot, and I have not seen any tools, anything that would indicate that type of work. I mean, that's an involved operation. You know, you need. I mean, you have to bring plywood up there. How big were those floors? You know, you would have to have stacks of plywood. You would have to have. You know, did you ever bring plywood up there?
No.
Did they ever ask you to bring tools or anything like that up there?
And one thing, the lighting wasn't that good on those floors.
The lighting.
The lighting wasn't that good on those floors. They had to bring in new. They had to bring in lights if they were going to do that.
The police detectives up there with flashlights, with these special, big ass flashlights. You know,
you would have
searching up there.
But this is the inside of the building where the sniper was. There's the detectives. They get it all downstairs now, trying to regroup after being stunned by this. There's one of the lights. The policemen that had some hard times. They're combing the building thoroughly.
Are you familiar with the Alton's photograph, the Alton 6 photograph, this photograph? Where Kennedy is seen here being shot already.
Yeah.
You know, and the motorcycle guys and everything. You've seen this picture many times.
Right.
And you know, you're aware that in the background, here in the background, there's figures in the doorway, okay?
I should have been one of the figures. I don't know if I am.
Well, that's what we're going to go over here. So you were located, you were standing in the entrance.
I was standing on top of the steps where you go in. I was on the outside.
On the outside.
Yeah, I was on that.
Around the bottom first step or second step?
No, I was on the first step up there.
That's right.
First step. Yeah.
Okay, the first step.
Before you get ready to step off.
That's right.
Yeah, I was on the first step.
Okay. Now, many people here have identified this right here as yourself. I'm just gonna put an arrow right there.
Who's supposed to be me?
Yeah, right there. It's a profile.
Maybe it may be me down there, but I don't.
Right. That's right. That's.
I don't see me up there.
Yeah. See, the thing is, it's a profile. Okay. It's a profile. It's this same person, but the reason being that the way that the photograph, I'm going to put it up here on the computer. Yeah, we might have to switch over here now real quick.
You may have to take this for you.
Yeah, what I'm going to do is go.
Okay, I'm showing Roy the Alton 6 photograph right now. Okay, now this is the doorway. Okay, and these figures here. And this African-American person right here, the profile of this person.
I think that
many people say that it's you.
I think it's me, yeah.
So you would identify that that's most probably you. You see, the thing is that I'm going to show you a close-up now of the photograph.
Okay.
And it's right here.
Why would I be looking that way? I should have been looking.
That's one of the reasons. One of the reasons I would love for you to tell me.
I wasn't
here.
Drunk, when I came out, I was looking at the cave.
Okay. You see this? This is the chest. See, the thing about, see, I've defined how the chest here, and this here is the doorman. We call this guy doorman. His left hand, and this is the person here, and then his chest comes down here, and this seems to be the same color uniform that person was wearing. That's like a khaki type of uniform, correct?
Yes, I don't know.
Well, I'll show you in our color photos of that. Okay. Now, let me go here.
And then Obi-Wan start getting sense.
So this is what I want to go into here. Okay, here's our Alton 6 photograph. Okay, and this is the man that is in question that apparently, as far as I'm concerned, because when you look at this other angle, seems to be
now,
you.
Now, that's me there, but you see my head, you see the direction and things are different.
I know, because this picture was taken after the assassination. This was taken from a car that came about 30 seconds afterward.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and then this is well afterwards.
Okay, hold on, go back to that.
Yeah, this is what I have the close-up right here. Okay? This is called...
Okay,
this
now
is,
that's me, right? That's me, right?
That's here. This is a Willis. This is called the Willis 7 photograph. Okay.
Why they got me looking that way?
That's right. Well, that's what I wanted to know.
Oh, well, I guess because he hadn't turned the corner yet.
No, this was after the assassination. This is about maybe 3 or 4 minutes after the assassination. Yes.
Really?
Yes. And you're looking in that direction. Now,
why am I looking in that direction?
Well, I was wondering about these vans here. You see these vans? It seems that you're looking in the direction of these vans that were on Elm Street on the other side of Houston. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if perhaps maybe you noticed some type of commotion there, you know. Hold on. Okay, here we go. Okay. And we're at point 9. Okay, you've already told me that you were located in the doorway. And now we're talking about the profile of the man in the doorway right here, and you say that's a very good chance that that's you, because that same person is this person, and you've already identified in the Wigman. This is called the Wigman slide 658, and in this slide you have identified yourself as that man right here, and then in the Willis slide you have also identified yourself in the doorway. Okay. Now my hypothesis, and something for you to confirm if that actually is you, because we're talking about the same group of people here, okay? And they couldn't have moved. I mean, this is exactly when this is happening right here, the Alton 6. This here, okay, this is a blow-up of the Alton 6 of this part of this right here, okay? So this right here is this over here, okay? It's just this is a blow-up of that photograph that I just showed you.
Okay. Are you saying that's Lee Harvey Oswald? Well, we're going to look like.
I'm going to show you.
It may look like him.
Well, I'm going to show you some state of the art computer overlays that I think prove that that's him. However,
well, I can tell you from them, it looks like him.
It looks like him, right?
All I can say.
Well, Roy is identifying Doorman as Lee Oswald. However, I want him to look at my overlays so that he can really appreciate the man who's in the doorway and how closely he resembles Lee Oswald. But I don't want to run and get ahead of myself, okay? So now did you see the
Okay, that was Roy Lewis, our witness and special guest tonight on The Real Deal here. And Roy was really giving us a lot of detail, and I want to welcome Professor Fetzer here onto the show right now. He's just arrived. Jim, I think we've nailed down a very important piece of the puzzle here with Mr. Roy Lewis. I called him earlier a pristine and uncontaminated witness because he's never been involved in any type of JFK activism or activity of any kind. He's never read any books. He's never actually looked at any of the images and photographs that survive to this day. For example, the Dave Wigman film, the Willis slide number 7, and most especially the Alton 6 photograph. So,
no, Larry, I think it's sensational, and I think it was very intelligent and resourceful of you to return to Roy, because, of course, you and I and Gary had visited his home on our previous road trip, visiting so many different locations that were important in relation to the assassination. So I'm very, very pleased and gratified you pursued this, and that you were so well received by Roy, who seems to me to be an invaluable access route to the distant past, remarkably enough.
Well, let me tell you, I found this man to be a very sincere, sober, and almost to a fault, you know, that he's soft-spoken, you know, and he's a family man. He's He's a church-going man. And you know, in every respect, the ideal witness, who's never come out, who's never seeked any of the limelight, okay, and somebody who is totally believable. And a lot of the things, Jim, that he's revealing here tonight, and I'm going to briefly go over here again with our audience, and because I have accompanied a lot of the images so that our audience could see and understand exactly what we're referring to and what we're talking about here. And specifically, what I wanted to start here, and I'm going to quote here from the interview, and this is Roy saying about Wesley Frazier. And this is right at the beginning. He says, the main guy you want to talk about is Wesley Frazier. He would pick him up every day and bring him to work. Now, in this clip that we just showed, he went into a little bit more detail. Now, this is something that had never been revealed to, before. This is something that right now here on The Real Deal, this is the very first time that this is being revealed by Roy Lewis. And specifically that Wesley Frazier would not only give Lee Oswald rides on weekends and take him to Irving, as has been put forth by the Warren Commission and has been believed for 52 years. Okay, this is the very first time, and I think this is extremely significant, Jim. What do you think?
Yeah, of course. I'm blown away, Larry. I mean, who would have thought we could have such a valuable witness appear after more than 50 years from the event?
Now, we had Edward Shields, because this was part of my presentation at Santa Barbara, that I spoke about Edward Shields, because my presentation was on Wesley Frazier. And Edward Shields did an interview for the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978, where he talked about what the African-American workers spoke about regarding Wesley Frazier dropping Lee Oswald off at the building, okay, right there on Houston. And Roy, independently, okay, let me stress this right now. Without Roy ever seeing what Edward Shields had said, Roy has confirmed exactly what Edward Shields put forth in this HSCA interview, which, let me tell you, what was never published as a documentation in the HSCA volumes. You have to find this as an addendum, okay, as an interview, an informal interview that they never put into the volumes of the HSCA. But regardless of that, the information that Edward Shields put forth and that revealed was that the African-American workers knew and were aware that Frazier used to drop Lee off right there on Houston and then go and park his car, not in the back, in front of the state building where the Warren Commission has him, as these images that we just showed our audience, well on the other side of the railroad tracks, which is totally ludicrous, because at that time, that Houston Street did not go through the railroad yards. You know, it used to be just railroad yards and railroad tracks and ruts and ditches and everything. On that day, it had been raining. It was muddy as heck, you know, and it's totally unbelievable that they would try to make us believe that Wesley Frazier and Lee Oswald went and parked all the way back there, and then he's revving his engine, and Lee Oswald goes and walks, you know, up to the building with a package under his arm, and I calculated it to be almost half a mile, all right, when the African-American workers, you know, spoke amongst themselves and were witness to Wesley Frazier dropping him off right there at the building, and then he would park over there at the bend of Houston where it turns into Ross, and like he did every day, and then Lee would walk into the northeast entrance of the building, and then Wesley Frazier would walk behind him. Okay, so that I find that to be extremely important, because he's confirming what Edward Shields said. And I think that's very important, in that respect right there, as far as Wesley Frazier is concerned. Okay. And I think that it's very important that he recognizes, look, you know, this is a guy that you need to take a little bit more interest in, you know, and we have, because you know that I have researched this guy, you know, for a while now.
Well, Roy, I mean, Larry, I think it's fascinating that Roy even turns out to be the man who had the black man's profile in front of Lee in the doorway. I mean, that's stunning.
Not only that, he's identified himself in the Wigman, okay, and in Willis 7, okay? He says, hey, that's me, you know? And then his first reaction when he sees the close-up of the Grodin scan there of the doorway, he says, that's Lee Harvey Oswald.
You know?
I just want to state this right now for the record. because I asked Roy, do you remember Lee Oswald being behind you? And he says, you know, I don't. But that's not, it doesn't mean that he wasn't there and that I can tell you as a witness that he was there. However, I wasn't concerned with anything that was going on behind me. I was only concerned with the parade, with the motorcade, you know.
Well, of course, you got the President of the United States and Jackie, the most glamorous couple in the world, right in front of you.
Yeah, he even says that he saw JFK brush his hair, okay, which we know that that's exactly, that was one of his actions there, you know.
Yeah.
And then another thing, and this has to do with, because I asked him later on if he had seen the motorcade stop, and he had seen the actions of the Secret Servicemen as we have revealed in our JFK Horseman series, and he said no, that he didn't. However, you and I have stood in that doorway, and you know that monument interferes with a lot of your field of vision going down.
Yes.
Elm Street. So it doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It just means it.
Well, we got the best possible witnesses, the motorcycle escort officers.
Right. Now another thing that's extremely important that I'm going to talk about now is the supposed refurbishing of the sixth floor. Now, this is incontrovertible here, Jim, because Roy says that did not happen. Okay, the floors up there, there was very poor lighting up there. If anybody would have known if there was work going on up there, would have been him, because he was at the bottom rung of the employee food chain there, so to speak, okay, because he'd lied to gain employment there. He was 16. He lied in 1962. He said that he was 18. So he was, you know, a worker there, and he would fetch books and move material around, you know, and use these dollies or hand trucks to move material. So if anybody would have been involved in taking plywood, sheets of plywood or tools, saws, hammers, you know, workbenches and stuff like that, it would have been Roy Lewis, okay? And he says that just didn't happen, okay? Now this is, I think, is extremely significant, extremely important, because this fairy tale about Bill Shelley running that crew up there and having Billy Lovelady and Danny Arce and Bonnie Ray Williams and whoever else, you know, they said that was up there working on refurbishing the floors, you know, it's a total lie. That just did not happen. And another thing, we have an OIC member by the name of Jay Knowles who was evaluated. He's looked at this and he's looked at all the photographs, because I also presented all the photographs that are on the, this clip was running, where it shows no evidence whatsoever of any work being done up there, which supports what Roy Lewis is saying. Okay. And so, Jay Knowles said, hey, you know, I'm a carpenter. I'm a professional carpenter. I know exactly what is required to do such a job. And, you know, it just didn't happen. Okay. And that's just the opinion of a professional. Okay. So as far as the refurbishing up there, he says that just didn't happen. And another thing that he's stressing, you know, the lighting up there was so bad. In fact, if you look at the Allier film, you'll see that the detectives that are up there searching the sixth floor are using these special big battery flashlights, and that's you can see, you know, and so this is all confirmed, you know, by actual some of the actual evidence that we have, you know, on the sixth floor. Another thing that I wanted to talk about was when that sniper's nest was actually constructed, when they moved those books over. He talks about 10:30 to 11 a.m. Okay, this is something that, and he said that's exactly the time. That's about the time that sniper's nest was built, because he went up there early in the morning at that time, and those boxes had already been placed, you know, in the exact position of the barricade or the sniper's nest, you know, as it was seen later on that afternoon, you know, with the boxes and everything, the way they were set up. Okay, now that's very significant. Okay, now another thing, when I asked him about the difference between Lovelady and Oswald, he said, look, you know, there was like night and day, you know. I showed him the photograph of Lovelady, taken by Mark Lane. Okay, he said, that's what Lovelady used to look like. And let me tell you a little story about Lewis and Lovelady. Roy Lewis told me that he purchased a car from Billy Lovelady, and it was either a Pontiac or a Buick, a 1957 or 1958, And that's how, why he knew Lovelady so well. And he could tell you exactly what his physical characteristics were. And he said, look, you know, he was heavier. He was shorter. He was almost completely bald. You know, I don't know why or how they would confuse Lovelady for Lee Oswald. These guys didn't even look alike, you know, physically, you know. And this is something that we've been talking about all along. Okay. So, those are just some of the things, you know, that, that we spoke about, and I was very excited because, you know, and you can hear me right now, you know, the way, you know, this thing has played out, you know. And another thing about the, how these workers were paid. You've read in the Warren Commission, Bill Shelley, O.V. Campbell, the paymaster, a man by the name of Aiken, okay, and all of them stayed in the Warren Commission that they paid all these workers in cash, okay. When I confronted, I asked Roy, you know, how did you guys get paid? He said, no, heck no, we never got paid in cash. All right. So what we have here is a direct witness to what was going on there in, at the TSPD. And I think this is extremely significant. And this is something that's going to be very hard to refute.
Well, of course, Larry. I mean, it's sensational in that you did this, that you tracked him down, that he was so cordial and forthcoming is all wonderful and fascinating. And as you and I have discussed, it's much, much better for a witness to get their views out into the public. I mean, they're much more safe because rather than silencing them by taking them out before they've spoken, after they've spoken, it simply invites more attention to what they had to say if you, you know, take them out. So I experienced this in a couple of cases in the long career of studying JFK, and those who have come forward have survived, and those who haven't, haven't.
That's right. And even Mr. Salandria, he urged me, you know, get this out now. You know, he said, do not wait. And I agree. You were the first one to tell me that, you know. And you know, it's just something I think this man has really, really set the record straight on this. And you know, there's now a lot of loose ends that need to be pursued here. You know, Jim, there's a lot of, now we have to look at this in a whole different light, in a whole different perspective. And a lot of the, maybe, you know, we're going to catch some heat, you know, from some people, but we always do, you know. But, hey, you know, I think that this has been incredible, incredible what this man has to say. And
Larry.
You know, yeah.
Well, it's sensational. I can't thank you enough. This is wonderful, wonderful stuff. You've made another major contribution to the history of the study of JFK. This is Jim Fetzer, your host.
Just one thing. I'm sorry, Jim. I just wanted to thank Lola Quesada, okay, who accompanied me on this venture. And I just wanted to say thank you, Lola, and love you, baby, okay?
Well, thanks very much, Larry Rivera, for being here, and all of you for watching.